American Ballpark. It's the Better Off Red podcast. Here's your host, Jamie Ramsey.
I'm joined by MLB.com writer Mark Sheldon. Mark, welcome to the premiere of season two of the Better Off Red podcast.
Wow. Season two premiere. It's big.
It's huge.
Congratulations on getting a season two.
Yeah, when I asked them, I said, is there any chance that I'll get a season two? Will you guys renew me? And they said, yeah, if the Cubs win the World Series. And I held them to it. So,
well, congratulations to the Cubs and to Jamie Ramsey. I'm glad it all worked out for you.
Hey, man, let's jump right into this this Red stuff. You want to?
Yeah, now that the World Series is over, it's like the hot stove season is full in right away.
You got that right. Hey, look, we just mentioned the Cubs. And we're talking about, you know, the possibility of how long it'll take the Reds to get there. As a general first question, give me your take on are the Reds close? Do you see some positivity in this in the future of this franchise, and your overall take on the organization as a whole?
I think they are not necessarily close, but I think the worst is behind them. If you look at the Cubs or the Astros or some of these other teams that went through a similar situation, it took about 4 years. Theoretically, then the Reds would be 2 years into this. And one thing that was encouraging was the second half of last year. You got all those guys back that were hurt. You got some guys that were brought in, you know, that kind of, you know, Jay Bruce was traded and Shevler was brought back. And you kind of got to see what the makeup of the team was going to be maybe for the future. And they went 36 and 37 in the second half. And they still didn't have everybody. I mean, Billy Hamilton and Cozart were missing most of the last month. So that's encouraging, and I think that's a good step. And they have a rotation of at least three or four starters that they feel like they can move forward with. The one thing that could hold them back is the Cubs, because the Cubs are not going anywhere for a while. I mean, not just because of the money they have and the big spending power, but they have a lot of young players that are not going to be leaving the organization for a while. Chris Bryant, Anthony Rizzo, Wilson Schwarber, Contreras. They're going to be around for a while, so that could hurt the Reds in their hopes to get back into the into contention. But at the same time, I think that there is a lot of young players here that people in the organization should be pretty pleased with.
And let's talk about that a little bit more. Give me some pros and cons that you took away from the 2016 season. I mean, obviously the team wasn't successful, finished in fifth place, but there were some shining lights, and I would like to hear you talk about that. But first, give me some of the cons that you were kind of disappointed in.
I think it was, you know, the bullpen certainly was terrible. And I mean, it got better when Iglesias and Lorenzen joined the fray. But I think just the amount of walks that the bullpen gave up was abysmal. The home runs are going to happen, and especially at a park like this, but not just here, anywhere the home runs happen, but the walks that came before the home runs was really just inexcusable. No matter whether you're a rebuilding team or not, you got to throw strikes if you're going to come in and try to keep a situation from getting out of control. Obviously in the first half, that was a problem because the bullpen was overused, but I don't feel like that was the case in the second half. And I feel like the walks still accumulated a little bit.
So despite the improvement into the second half, you saw that the walk rate was still high for the
without having the numbers in front of me. It just still felt like there were pitchers, like, I remember it just seemed like, and I'm going to kind of make it more anecdotal, but it seemed like when Jumbo Diaz came in, he was good for at least a walk. Tony Cingrani always gave up a walk. I think I remember counting that, you know, over a stretch of like 10 appearances from like August into September, I think he didn't get the first batter out. And whether it was a walk or a hit. And I just think those are the kind of things that have to absolutely drive a manager and a pitching coach berserk. And it certainly drives a fan berserk. As a media member, you just kind of scratch your head. And I think that's something that was really glaring last season, and they really need to address that going into 2017. I think they need some more depth in the bench, which is something that Dick Williams talked about, and he talked about with all the media last month. I think the bench was a little thin. You didn't have that guy that could come off the bench and change a game for you in the seventh or eighth inning. I think it's a success and a failure in a way. Joey Votto was comatose for 2 months of the season, but man, he really did come on at the end. I think those are some of the things that were on the downside, but there's a lot of positives too.
Yeah, and before we get to the positives, if those are the only kind of, and not, they're probably not the only things, but the most glaring problems that you saw in 2016, you know, taking off my Reds hat for a second, that's not a bad thing to overcome, don't you think?
It's definitely overcomeable. I mean, it's not, oh, this team has no chance of ever rebounding from 98 and 94 losses. I mean, there's some things that could have been done better. The rotation certainly could have been better. I mean, Homer Bailey not being able to pitch more than five or six games is a definite negative, but it's Tommy John surgery, and there's a certain amount of mystery to that still, even though it's become a more common procedure. But I think the areas where the team fell short were the areas where they spent the less, bullpen, bench.
Would you say defense was also something that could have been improved upon?
In some areas. I mean, Joey Votto's defense certainly declined. Jay Bruce, until he got traded, was not the Jay Bruce that we have seen in the past defensively. You know, Brandon Phillips, I would say, is no longer Gold Glove caliber at defense. He was still capable of a good play now and again. Suarez, though, as rough as he was in the first maybe 2 months of the season, he did make improvements. And I think there are people that made better strides defensively, whether it be Billy Hamilton. Adam Duvall was a surprise defensively. Tucker Barnhart stepped into an everyday role, and I thought he played pretty good defense. So
Adam Duvall could very well win the Gold Glove.
He could win the Gold Glove, which would be absolutely astonishing for a guy that did not play a lot of outfield until he got to this organization. He was mostly a corner infielder and not a very good one. So he's got a nice shot at being a Gold Glove winner.
Is Billy Hamilton the best center fielder you saw in 2016?
Yeah, I know a lot of people like Ender Inciarte, and he could very well take the Gold Glove from Hamilton, maybe because of the last month of the season he didn't play very much. But just on a day-in and day-out basis, and the fact that I was lucky enough to see that, you know, we always talk about all the electric things that Hamilton can do that we don't see very often when he's on the bases, but very often we kind of forget about the defense. And that play he made, the diving catch he made on the warning track with his head going into the wall, was probably one of the finer ones you're going to see.
Sure. Okay, now we talked a little bit about the critiques of the 2016 team and the organization. What did you see during the year that you were pleasantly surprised about, and something that that the team can take into the future that that you didn't necessarily predict at the beginning of the 2016 season?
Well, we'll start with Dan Straley, only because he wasn't even here until the day before the season, I believe, or 2 days. He was a late pickup, kind of a journeyman already. He was on his third team in a week, and it was going to be a long reliever. And suddenly, when all the injuries happened and guys started falling down or some performance issues, he stepped in. And what surprised me was a guy that doesn't throw very hard, kind of has a Bronson Arroyo-like repertoire, was able to be as successful as he was. Even though he led the league in home runs allowed, he didn't walk a lot of guys. So I think 24 of his 31 homers were solo shots. But he's also very, very – he had a lot of craftiness to him that he can learn how to do some things to get elicit maybe not so good contact. And also he was a really good teammate. I mean, you look at – someone like Brandon Finnegan, he worked on his changeup with Dan Straley. Dan Straley showed him a grip and kind of helped Finnegan get straightened out. And I think that's something, on a performance level on the field, but off the field, he showed to be one of the clubhouse leaders of a guy that wasn't even in the organization in March. So I thought that was pretty impressive. Adam Duvall, obviously, you know, we saw his numbers in AAA, but there was really no way to think that he could be an all-star. I don't think anyone would have said going into the season that Adam Duvall was going to be one of the Reds' all-stars. And
were you surprised about the power? I know that's something that he's always had, but, I mean, 30 home runs, I mean, that's mighty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, I guess not so much the power, but it's because he hit, like, I think five homers down the stretch when he came up last year, and he had a history, at least in the minors, of hitting 25 to 35 homers, so you knew he had the power. Whether he could do it up here was another story. And for as long as he did, you know, he did fall off a little bit in the second half, but the fact that he was sustaining that kind of power for the first, you know, 4 months of the season pretty well, I thought that said a lot for him, and was definitely surprised. Again, the defense was stunning. I thought he really did have a nice year. He deserved to be an all-star, and he has a lot to be excited about going into next season and suited the Reds for that.
Yeah, especially I think talking about his defense again, it's he came up as a corner infielder, and yeah, that's all he knew until, I mean, essentially a couple of years ago. So,
and he made good judgment on balls. He had some assists. He was able to throw guys out. He took some good routes. I mean, these are the things, the finer points that you don't look at as much. You look at, everyone always looks at the errors or the this and that, but he played smart left field, and he was able to do things out there that saved a run here and there, and you can't take that for granted.
Going back to Straley for a second, you led off with him as far as the positive stuff for 2016. What changed for him?
You know, just when I talked to him at the last day of the season, he didn't say that much changed. He kind of stuck with what got him to be here. He said he gave a lot of credit to Tucker Barnhart and Mac Jenkins for knowing him quickly and learning him and going and looking at his strengths of pitches, and that was his slider and his changeup, and really working on that. And using the data that they had from StatCast and all the other information that they compile here in the organization of what would make him most successful. He also spent last offseason up in Washington State at this academy called Driveline, which really maximizes the amount of data, and they use a lot of information to maximize the pitches he does have. But he also did some strengthening with his shoulder, with weighted baseballs and things like that. He threw 191 innings. He said he was never sore the day after a start all season, other than the general, like, regular stuff, but never anything more than that. He never felt like there was a day he couldn't throw, and that was big.
Is this something that he was going to continue into this offseason?
He wasn't planning on going to Washington State. Now that he's established the baseline and he has the equipment, like the weighted baseballs in his own, he will work out at home in Oregon, and he has people he can work with, so he says he's going to continue that. But if he felt like he needed to go up, you know, make the two-hour flight up to Washington, he would do it.
Switching gears here to talk about some of the other Reds personnel, on-field personnel. What's the latest on Devin Mesoraco?
There hasn't been a whole lot. We saw him in the clubhouse doing his workouts and things like that towards the end, and you know, just being around. But right now, it sounds like he's still on target to be able to start catching again, or at least catching drills in mid to late January, which is awfully late. I think he got started a little bit earlier last year and obviously wasn't 100% at spring training. So as far as I know, there's no deviation. I haven't been told anything that he's behind schedule.
And that's a thing that a lot of Reds fans, especially the more, you know, knowledgeable fans, always cite as far as things that they're worried about. They're worried about whether Devin can come back and catch 130 games a year. And if he can, is he going to be the same player at the plate? What are your thoughts, maybe your opinions, your analysis on that?
I think three major surgeries in less than 2 years is a big red flag. And I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, he'll be fine. Because I don't think we know that. I don't think we know that he won't be fine. I think it's, in this day and age, we always want to know all the answers right away, but this is one of those cases where we really have to watch him play. He has to go through spring training. He has to be beat up by the bouncing ball, you know, the balls in the dirt, and do all the drills and get up and get down and get up and get down. And then he has to play 100-plus games in the season to show that he is 100% behind these injuries. And I would think, just because of he's starting the drills in January, I wouldn't expect him to be ready to start the season, just in my head. I think they're going to have to be as cautious as they can. They also have the luxury of Tucker Barnhart, that if he's healthy, that he can play and be a starter. And I think if you go to a hybrid situation where maybe this year they split the job and they both get about 80 games, I think that'd be okay. And then if Mesoraco shows that he can get through that, maybe you go back in I think the third or fourth year of his contract, and he could try to do 120, 130 games.
And speaking of some of the positive things that we talked about earlier, and Tucker Barnhart, I think Tucker Barnhart established himself as a bona fide major league catcher this year.
Oh, absolutely. He went through the grind of catching every day, and it wasn't an easy. This was not an easy pitching staff to catch this year. It was obviously a challenge having a bazillion starters. They didn't have the same five guys like they did in 2012. He had a lot of guys to work with, a lot of challenges in the other bullpen, and then he was able to hit too. And that's the thing. Usually for a younger catcher, maybe a guy experiencing everyday catching it the first time, the first thing that goes down the drain is their hitting, because they're just worn down. And he hit pretty well, and he was clutching runners in scoring position. So he hit some home runs from the right side, which he hadn't done a whole lot of in the minors. It's something he never did in the majors. So it's definitely a surprise, and he's definitely shown that if Mesoraco can't do it for whatever reason, he could do it.
A couple guys that finished the year a little banged up included Billy Hamilton and Brandon Phillips. Do you any word on them, news or any updates on those guys?
No, and I should have asked when I talked to the general manager yesterday. I was going through my litany of things, but you know, the kind of injury that Hamilton had was the oblique, and that's really a rest injury. It doesn't take a whole lot to aggravate it when you're playing, but when you're in the off season, he has plenty of time to let that heal. And I would imagine I'd be shocked if that comes into play for him when he gets back to spring training. Phillips was just had so many things that were banged up, and he's 36. He's another guy I think is really just, he needs an off season just to heal up. I mean, he banged up his toe and he banged up his shin and he got hit on the hand a couple times. And I mean, the guy just got beat up, and to his credit, you know, he has a lot of detractors, but to his credit, he did not want to sit out of any games, and he was able to really kind of, you know, finish the season, and he did pretty well.
What do you think of Eugenio Suarez in 2016?
Really kind of a pleasant surprise, in the sense that, you know, he didn't really play any third base, and he moved over there, and he looked great in spring training. Once the game started and it got real, you kind of saw he had some challenges. He had like 12 errors in 53 games, but then he was able to work through it. And he admitted that there were times that he wasn't prepared or he wasn't focused enough. And he learned that being a third baseman, you had to be literally focused on every single pitch, and you had to be ready for the routine ball as much as the outstanding play. But those routine balls come up on you so fast, much faster than shortstop. And I think that was one thing he learned. And you know, he went through his ebbs and flows offensively. He went through a nice stretch where he hit a lot of home runs, and then he'd fall off. He had an 0 for 28 in May, and he struggled throughout much of May. But he never gave up, and he was able to kind of grow. And I think of all the players, of those that young crew of players, I think he may have showed the most growth from April to October than anyone else on the team. He kind of saw him coming to his own. He was so quiet last season. He was he didn't speak a lot. English isn't his first language, but you know, he didn't really do a lot of talking with the media as far as, you know, small talk and hanging out and things like that. And this year he was able to joke around with people. He was definitely one of the clubhouse guys that kind of stood out to me off the field. And he certainly had a good year. I thought he had a nice year to build on, and he should be right in the middle of it 2017.
And I would agree with that 2017, but let me ask you this, what kind of future does he have with a guy like Nick Senzel down there waiting in the wings?
That's going to be interesting, because not only is his old position seemingly spoken for, whether it's from Zach Cozart for the short term or Jose Peraza for the long term, Suarez, he might be a guy that either becomes trade value for someone else or he has to find a new position, because I can't imagine Nick Senzel going somewhere else. He might be the next Chris Bryant to some people. So, but at the same time, I don't think they're going to rush Senzel. This organization seems to have shown tremendous patience and caution when it comes to rushing prospects. I don't think they're going to, you know, hustle him through. And Jesse Winker is example A of that. They didn't rush Jesse Winker, and they could have made a case to bring him up in April if they wanted to, and they waited. And it was the right decision, obviously. And I think with Senzel, you know, maybe he doesn't come up next season, but I think 2018, he definitely could come up, and Suarez will still be here. So they have to figure something out.
Yeah. I think the latest Baseball America survey came out at the end of the season, and it said of the Reds minor league prospects that Senzel was the closest to the big leagues. So when you have a guy that has potential like Eugenio Suarez, who is starting to get a foothold in the major leagues, possibly hit 20 to 30 home runs a season, I think it's his defense and that he would probably have to work on the most, maybe some consistency at the plate. But does it kind of, you think maybe knowing that, basically what I'm asking is, do you think he feels the footsteps behind him, or is that something that you think young players like Suarez might feel? I know, like, you know, when the Reds had a surplus of catching prospects, whenever a new catcher would get drafted, I'd know for a fact, I spoke to some of the guys that were already established, like they knew what was behind them. Do you think maybe that factors in on the Suarez side?
He strikes me as a somewhat of a chill person that doesn't sweat the details too much, but at the same time, I think he'll be aware of it in spring training. If Nick Senzel gets a major league invite to camp, which I wouldn't be surprised if he got one, and he sees how he plays, I think that might be the first wake-up call or the splash of water that says, hey, I'm going to have to keep going if I want to keep my job in Cincinnati, or as want to happen, if he becomes surplus, a team that might want him. I mean, if you look at players that have left the Reds that maybe weren't even doing well here, they went on to do better things elsewhere, or they were doing well, got moved on, got a free agent deal. And so I think it would behoove him to definitely continue to work on his skills. He said he's going to definitely be working this offseason at third base. He wants to be better defensively. He wants to be better offensively. He says he really worked on going all fields this year, and it showed. And I think half of his home runs were to center or right field. So he's not just resting on what he's done so far. I think he really wants to take the next step and not just be an average player. I think he wants to be a really good player.
Where do you see this Reds middle infield from 2016 to 2017? Basically, what I'm asking is Zach Cozart and Brandon Phillips going to be your double play combination on opening day?
I would be a little surprised, but if they were both there, I think there's just demand for a guy like Zach Cozart, who's affordable. He's got a year left until free agency. He obviously is a good teammate and a good guy, and he has some pop. He had 16 homers, and his defense is without dispute how good it is. So I think he's marketable. Phillips, I don't see any scenario where he's not here. I think he had an opportunity to be traded last year, coming off a 98 loss season, and the manager was Dusty Baker, and he still did not take that trade to the Nationals. And that just shows me that for whatever reason, he's comfortable here. He's obviously one of the team's biggest celebrities. I think he enjoys that life, and I think he enjoys the being known, and I don't think he'd really want to go to another team and be just a guy. However, he did tell me in Milwaukee, I think right towards the end of the season, that he really does want to win a World Series, and he's aware that he's 36. Time is not infinite anymore for him, and to be really honest, I mean, if we're going back, this is year three of a rebuild. A World Series may not be happening in the final year of his contract. So if he wants to win one, he may want to think a little harder about if an offer comes from a competitive or a contending team, he may want to think about taking it.
So that begs the question, where does Jose Peraza fit into this 2017 team?
Well, if Cozart's traded, he's the shortstop. Easy. If Phillips is traded and Cozart stays, he's the second baseman. Dilson Herrera lurks in the wings as a future second baseman, so it could be a Cozart-Herrera combination.
Sure. Yeah, let's talk about Dilson Herrera a little bit. What do you know about him? Of course, he's the marquee player that came over in the Jay Bruce trade. I know that there are some big-time pros for Dilson Herrera. What do you know about him, and what's your analysis?
I heard that his star kind of dimmed a little bit in the Mets organization. He came up, he struggled, and then he didn't. He went back to AAA and it was okay. But he's a guy that has good defensive skills, but can hit. I don't know if he'll ever be the kind of second baseman if Brandon Phillips was when his prime, but he definitely has the ability to be a very strong up the middle guy and that can hit. Apparently, he slept on his shoulder funny and on a bus trip this year when he got to Louisville, and
it happens.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been there, I guess. But he wasn't able to come up for that whatever reason, so they're gonna give him the offseason to get ready, and I would imagine him challenging for a spot. I would be surprised that if let's say Phillips and Cozart are both still here, I would be surprised if Herrera did not make the team as a bench guy unless they feel like he needs to play every day in AAA. But I think he's been in AAA long enough that he could be a guy that comes up here and pushes for a spot if there's room for him.
So let's talk about the bench a little bit. I know the Reds are what they're trying to do moving forward is to do something like talk about the Cubs too much here, but have guys that can play more than one position and not just do that, but contribute at each of those positions. Do you see anybody on this current team that will be in the mix for 2017 that can contribute and be comfortable playing multiple positions off the bench?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, if you're a National League team in general, you need those guys. It's the Cubs didn't break new ground or frontier by having, flexible, versatile players. That's something that should be with every National League team. You can't just have guys focused on one spot. as far as the Reds go, they have a lot of utility guys, it seems like, whether it's DeJesus or Ira Barron towards the end and things like that. But they didn't have a guy that I hate to use Matt Stairs as that example because he's not the guy I want to use, but you didn't have a power guy. And that was one thing that was missing. And if they had a power guy that could play outfield and a corner infield spot or a catching, they tried a little bit with Jordan Pacheco going into the year. It didn't work, but those are the guys they need to find. Ira Barron's 32. I don't know if, he got designated and I don't know if he'll go somewhere else or not, but I think if he was in spring training, he might be a guy that they would look to have in camp again and maybe make the team. I think he showed that he could hit. And I think having just a straight hitter like him can only help. He won the International League batting title and he's competent. I think he played four positions. And I think those are the kind of guys you need to have. DeJesus did not do anything wrong. I mean, he was a very competent backup infielder who could play multiple positions in left field. But they didn't really have a extra outfielder that could be plugged in behind Duvall or Bruce/Schebler that they could have, for double switches that they could come in and play as good of defense but also hit. I mean, Tyler Holt did not fit that bill. He could play defense, but he could not hit. And that's something they need to find.
Sure. What's the possibility of Jesse Winker as the starting right fielder for the Reds in 2017?
Well, I think it's Schebler's job to lose, and I think Schebler would have to take a dip. I don't think he necessarily will, but the one thing that Winker didn't do last year in AAA was hit for power. I mean, I think he hit like three homers, maybe five. I can't remember, but I think that was something that maybe is an alarm bell for some, but he could hit, and I think if he can show some power in this coming spring, and being that he's a prospect, I think he'll get every chance to possibly win that job. I don't think Scott Schebler should go in thinking it's absolutely his job. I think it's his to lose, but I don't think it's his job. And I think if he can show that he can still throw and hit for power that he did and not take the dip that he did in the beginning of April like he did, I think he'll keep the job. But I think Winker's right there, and I don't think they'd hesitate to bring him up if he shows some power in Louisville if he does start the season in the minors.
MLBpipeline.com rated Aristides Aquino as the Reds' best prospect in 2016. What do you know about him, and does he have a chance to possibly make this 2017 team?
That's a good question. It's funny is that Aquino, if I'm not mistaken, was a Rule 5 exposed player. He could have been plucked. I mean, he had an injury. I think he had an arm injury. He broke his arm or something like that and was available, and no one took him. And then he went out and had a great year. I mean, anytime you're the minor league player of the year, and I think he played up – did he get to AAA? Yeah.
I think he primarily was at Daytona in advanced class A.
Sorry. You can edit that out. Yeah, so I don't see him being up in 17 then. If he's at advanced A, I don't think they would jump him those many levels, but I think he's a guy that they'll have to watch. And
possibly an invite?
I would think he'd be an invite. Yeah. He's earned that and nothing else, but I don't see him being in the mix for a job.
But you would say that, when people say, when the Reds, and we'll get to this in a second, about the young pitching that's coming up through the farm system, everybody talks about the pitching, but they don't talk about any boppers down there. And I would think that Aquino definitely has to be considered a bright power hitter in the Red system.
Well, the one thing that is, though, is that it's a lot easier for a pitcher to get on the express lane and get up to the major leagues, whether it's from Double A, even sometimes it happens from Single A, but it's very rare. I think hitters, it's a more nuanced situation. Obviously, the hitters are already at a disadvantage when they get here in the first place, as it is. And I think it's a harder adjustment from minor league pitching to major league pitching. I don't think it's quite as much of an adjustment for the pitchers. And so I would imagine it's going to take Aquino a little while to get up here. I mean, obviously, Jesse Winker's now been as fast-tracked as he seemed to be. They hit the brakes on him pretty quick. He was injured a little bit, but they're not rushing him. And I think that I can't imagine they would do the same with Aquino.
One of the best pieces I've ever seen regarding the Reds was something that you wrote several years ago now about Aroldis Chapman and the genesis of his signing with the team. That was, I think, brilliant. And I think for folks listening, it's definitely worth going back and checking that out. Mark did an amazing job putting that together. And with that being said, to use a Brian Price expression, what do you know about some of these recent Cuban acquisitions that the Reds have made, namely Alfredo Rodriguez and Vladimir Gutierrez?
Well, Rodriguez was a shortstop, and they really went out on a limb with him in a way. I mean, they spent a considerable amount of money for a guy that is not as much of a sure thing, so to speak, as maybe Chapman was as a pitcher. I mean, you kind of, Chapman had a quantity at least that you knew he threw 100 miles an hour, and that was pretty impressive. And you kind of wonder, again, talk about guys thinking about guys that are behind them, you know, what's going to happen with Cozart now, Peraza, and now you have Rodriguez in the pipeline. So it's really a mystery of what it could become of him and how he'll integrate into the mix. But I know that they were high on his glove. They thought he was a defensive first guy. I don't think he was known for his bat. They said that he did show some more hitting ability, I think what they saw in their scouts, but I think historically he has not been known for hitting. The other guy, Gutierrez, we met him. He was here briefly, and Reyes de la Iglesia didn't know him well. They kind of only knew each other through social media, but he did know of him, and he knew he was a decent pitcher. I think Tony Arias told me through in the mid-90s, had a lot of life. They had some good secondary pitches, and they do feel like he's got some potential to be here. I don't know how long it'll take him to be here. He's got after a year plus off, he went into the instructional league, and you know it takes a while. Iglesias was able to have the opportunity after his year off to go into the Arizona Fall League and the Instructional League and kind of get in. But I think he was a little bit more of an advanced case. And I'm not sure if he's as Gutierrez is as advanced as Iglesias was when he got here.
Are you impressed with the way the Reds are, tackling the international market? And it's my opinion, and I know I'm going to get people that disagree with me here, but payroll plays a lot into the success of teams, no matter what. I think sometimes baseball would like to make you think that it doesn't, but the Indians were 22nd in payroll. They're the only team in 2016, excuse me, in the second tier, the back 15 teams to make the playoffs. With that, and then the way the Reds are stockpiling talent, tackling the draft, they were just ranked number one by Baseball America in the 2016 draft, going after the international guys. Are you impressed with the trying to make, for a lack of a better term, making lemonade out of lemons?
Well, I think it is impressive in the sense that they're not leaving any stones unturned. When you're a small market team, you have to find creative ways to skin the cat, so to speak, and we both love cats, so I apologize for using that term, but it's they've been doing this for a while, though. I mean, even before the current administration, so to speak, when a few years ago they went and got pretty creative in getting Juan Duran and Yorman Rodriguez here, it maybe so far it appears it's not be working, but they took a chance on two 16-year-olds that had a lot of promise and outlaid a lot of money, and it showed that they were serious about the international world. And I know Tony Arias is well respected in the industry, and he's a guy that's been out scouring the earth for different levels of talent
and combing
the desert they're not giving up on guys. And when the Reds are a player in a Cuban free for all that very well, honestly, that should usually belong to the teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Dodgers, and they beat everyone to get Chapman. They got Rodriguez, and there's a lot of teams that were interested in him, and then they were taking advantage of the fact that the Dodgers pretty much hit their ceiling of what they could outlay because of the luxury tax. And now of all the teams in the major leagues this going into this next season, the Reds are at the top of the luxury tax threshold, so they really can't spend any more money. And I think they've shown, hey, we've scaled back the payroll, but they've invested in the draft and scouting and development, and they've also put a big premium on international scouting and signings, and that's how they want to rebuild and get back into the contention.
Just to be frank, do you think that's what they need to do moving forward? And your opinion?
I think like every team, especially the small market teams, you have to have a diversified approach. You can't say just more international or more draft. You have to approach it from different ways. The one way they can approach it is through outspending everyone on the free agent market. The only way they can do this is by spending smartly internationally and then drafting well and developing all of it through the system. And I think they're definitely showing that they're able to do that more. And I think they're taking big steps. But I don't think just throwing a lot of money internationally, it's too it's a little bit risky in the sense that there's you know, the numbers are not necessarily as reliable. You're dealing with a lot of different variables. The level of competition is not as good. Cuba maybe is closer to being major league competition than some other countries are, and you get a better sense of what the talent is. But I don't think you can assume that if you spend a lot of money internationally that all these guys are going to hit. I think there's a lot more misses sometimes just because you just don't know. I mean, plus guys that have honestly that have had nothing their entire life suddenly get millions of dollars. It does possibly change your outlook on life a little bit. And that could also affect how they play.
The Dick Williams regime has just recently taken over full time now in the Reds front office. What do you see from Dick personality wise moving forward that you think will benefit this team, and anything that you think will look noticeably different in the Reds front office than when Walt was here as the main baseball man?
Well, I think he's a very smart and capable person. It was interesting is that he came in from a non-baseball background and spent 10 years learning the business. His resume does not have baseball in it before 2006. And to his credit, he never rested on his name or his background, and he went and got his fingers dirty and went and learned the business. And he's a smart guy, and he seems to be very comfortable in his own shoes, and he's definitely a communicator with not just media, but also it seems like with the front office and with people around the game. He's able to take phone calls and make phone calls and make deals happen. He's been involved in some of the deals that they've made already in the past year or so. So I don't know how much it'll be different. I guess the one thing that'll be interesting to see is, you know, Walt Jocketty was very comfortable and very laid back. I don't think Walt worried about a lot of things too much. He I think pretty much anything that happened in baseball, he's kind of seen it before. So I'll be interested to see how he handles the day-to-day grind of the job, and it does eat you up. I would imagine all the phone calls that are required, all the contract negotiations, all the, you know, the media requests and things like that. I'll also be curious to see what kind of people he surrounds himself with. I don't know. The organization somewhat is seamless. They made the transition. Walton advisor, Nick Crawl and Sam Grossman are still here as assistant GMs. But I'd be curious to see if Dick surrounds himself with a former GM or a former assistant GM or somebody with major league experience that's done this before and have an inner circle. I think a lot of GMs kind of form their personalities with the inner circle they surround themselves by. And we have yet to see who he's going to surround himself with.
You spoke to both Walt and Dick several times, lots of times on the phone, in person, whatnot. Do you see a different approach from each of these guys? Do you think they both see the game the same way, or do you think it's a different style that these guys are going to, or you're going to see out of Dick?
You're going to see a different style. I think Walt definitely leans towards the more old school approach, and I think he's big on scouting and the eyeball. And I think Dick might be a little bit more analytical and bottom line with the numbers. I mean, he's a numbers guy from his business background, and he's got, you know, one of the first things that happened when he became GM last year, I don't think it was coincidental, is that they really invested highly and more into the analytics department. And I think that there is going to be a much more analytical approach to how the decisions are made. I think that information was used in the past. I'm not saying Walt didn't use it. I'm sure he did. I know he did. But I think he was a guy that, you know, like for an example, Skip Schumacher's numbers are a sabermetric nightmare to seam heads and those kind of people. They would never, ever want to see Skip Schumacher walk into the building. But Walt knew from his St. Louis days and just from the word of mouth that Skip Schumacher, every team needs a Skip Schumacher in their clubhouse because he's the guy that can influence games in different ways. And it may not jump off the stat sheet, but he's a guy that you want to go into a game with, just because, especially a pressure game, because he knows how to handle himself and he knows how to keep a clubhouse going and he knows how to keep guys accountable, quite frankly. And I'll be curious to see if the new regime values those kind of players that don't necessarily jump off the stat sheet. I mean, not everyone can be sabermetrically, advanced statistically, you know, dream players. So there's got to be a good mix. And I think while Dick might be analytical, I think he's smart enough to know that he needs some intangibles as well.
I know I'm a little bit all over the place with the questions that I'm throwing at you today, Pepper. And you're doing a great job. But a few more. We spoke a little bit about Raisel Iglesias. What do you see his role next year? And if it's not as a closer, who is the Reds' closer in 2017, or is it just kind of by committee?
I think the playoffs this year have put the bullpen in a focus like it's never been before.
I would agree with that,
yeah. And I think now, I mean, there's been people that have been clamoring for years to get rid of the old way of by the book, so to speak, of, you know, you have a 3-run lead in the ninth inning, bring in your closer. The most pressure situation in the seventh inning, you're going to bring in your third or fourth best reliever. And I think those days are kind of ending a little bit. And just getting the sense that they really want to have multiple inning power guys that can be counted on for 30 to 50 pitches, 2 to 3 innings, whether it's to finish a game, if it's to bring in Iglesias in the sixth inning to get 2 innings out of him and then bring someone else in, I think they'd be willing to do that. I think Iglesias is the so-called closer, in my opinion. I think that's the way to go if his shoulder demonstrates that he can handle it. And I think they felt like he passed the sniff test on that towards the end. I think he's got the mentality for it, so I think he should close. But I also think the days of he's only going to pitch in the ninth inning are probably over. I think if Brian is looking at the scenario and he's got a situation that calls for Iglesias in the seventh inning, I think he might use him. If he's got a situation where Michael Lorenzen's his setup guy, who I think he should be a setup guy, but it's the fifth inning, I think Andrew Miller's the guy and brings him in and rides him till he's done. And I think that's cool.
Yeah, and you know what? You said that you think that this postseason has really kind of been a renaissance for that. I would agree 100%. I think what we've seen, and I think it started with Dave Roberts and the LA in the series with the Cubs, that the when he brought in Kenley Jansen in the seventh inning, it was like, I think it opened everybody's eyes. Like, this is kind of how it should be. And I agree. It's my opinion. Maybe I shouldn't, you know, speak on it, but I agree with that. I think instead of we've always been told that he's the closer, I think now we're going to be told that he's the bullpen ace. I think the wording's going to become different. I think all of a sudden, and let's be honest, it's not really going to behoove the agents of these guys. No. I think they're going to have a problem with it at first.
They will push back.
They will push back because saves is a stat that for some reason we put a lot of monetary interest in. And I think until that changes, I think that's got to change at the top and meet somewhere in the middle with what we saw during this postseason.
We need new stats to describe the success of a reliever, and the hold is worthless in a sense, and the save is becoming worthless if it's not already to some people. I mean, it's a nice feather in your cap. I mean, it does take a certain guy to finish a game. I'm never going to sit there and say that the ninth inning is the same as the seventh inning. Even a 3-run lead with nobody on base in the ninth inning is still, there's for whatever reason, there's still pressure to finish a game and get the win and leave and shake hands. But yes, the roles of changing. I mean, ask Buck Showalter now if he regrets not bringing his closer into a game. He had an elimination game, and Zach Britton was nowhere to be found, and they paid for it. He didn't bring his best pitcher in for the situation that needed it, and he paid for it. Kenley Jansen threw 51 pitches, I think, like you said, and Clayton Kershaw, of all people, had to close that game. And they have to find, I think, managers are going to have to be more flexible. They're going to have to be more willing to go out on a limb and say, you know what, I brought my best pitcher in the seventh. I managed to win the inning. And then hopefully the game, now that I'm down to my fifth best pitcher for the ninth, I had to use him and we lost, but I did it. And I think the idea of going by the book and settling for, you know, copping out, so to speak, that I managed the game like it's always been managed and it didn't work. I don't think that's acceptable anymore.
It's a fascinating topic, and it creates great conversation. And I think we could talk about it a little bit longer even. I think Brian was open to it, I think when he talked to you guys at the end of the season, that was one of the things that stood out, like in his, I don't want to say, you know, like the annual, like yeah. going into the off season, talk to the media, was that was the big thing that he said was, I'm open and I'm kind of leaning towards using this bullpen differently.
Yeah. I think it's something he wanted to do. I remember when he first got the job and it came up in spring training about with Chapman, hey, would you be open to using Chapman in the seventh inning? And he said he was, and he said he was open to doing things differently, but then he went and did it by the book, and he didn't do that. But I could tell he kind of wants to do it. I think he was trying to be careful and be safe, and obviously Chapman maybe didn't want to come in the seventh inning, quite frankly. I don't know. I never heard that, but I think now there's definitely forward thinking going on. I think Brian's a smart guy, and he's also a guy that's not – willing to necessarily stick with the status quo. I think he's willing to try some things. And I think not only that, you have to have the right people. And I think he's got two pitchers in Iglesias and Lorenzen that could handle it. They could probably look at the system they have now and see who doesn't make the rotation and have a third guy. Because you know that there's going to be some people, whether it's Stevenson or I mean, there's four spots really kind of spoken for in the rotation. There's a lot of guys that are capable of going to that fifth spot. But some of those guys aren't going to get the job, and you got to look and maybe see if you can find use for them other ways. I mean, Tim Adelman could be a type of guy that could be a bullpen starter, swingman kind of thing. And I think you're going to see more of those guys that are capable of giving you three or four innings of relief. But if you had to plug him in as a starter, you got him as a starter. Kevis Sampson was another example of that.
Yeah, and we'll continue talking about pitching. Some of these young guys that came up this year that the organization and the Reds fans that were excited about kind of were a little underwhelming, namely Cody Reed and Robert Stevenson. What did you see in their performance in 2016 that you think is it a growing pains, or is it something that maybe the Reds should be concerned about, or is it just the way things are going and that they'll be fine?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I thought Stevenson, his demeanor really honestly wasn't very impressive in spring training. He did not handle the pressure of going for that job very well. The walks piled up, and I got the sense that he was a little hard-headed, and that really did come to fruition when he was taken behind the media woodshed by Delino DeShields in public, who basically said he wasn't adjusting. And I don't know if that was an eye-opener for Stevenson, but it should have been if it wasn't. And I think he needs to develop and grow. He has to cut down on the walks. He has to be willing to throw more pitches than just this fastball. He's got to find diversity in his repertoire. And I think if he can do that, he could go places and be successful. Cody Reed, I think, is one of those situations where I think he wasn't afraid to try throwing other pitches. He had a fastball and a slider and a changeup, and he's a power pitcher. He's imposing looking on the mound, and he threw filth in spring training and just made a lot of major league hitters look bad. Made a lot of minor leaguers work even worse. But I think he just never struggled before. And I think when he got hit hard here, you could totally see, like, when he first got up, okay, the first game, it's struggled, but I'm okay. And then as the home runs accumulated, as the struggles accumulated, you could see he just looked defeated. And sometimes it's mental. And I think he's got the stuff. I think you look at him and he's built as a major league pitcher. I would not want to face him, especially as a left-handed person. I would not want to face that guy ever. I don't want to face any of these guys, but especially him. And I think
the goggles are intimidating.
Yeah, he's got the goggles and the beard, and he looks like, probably on the mound, he probably looks like he's 7 feet tall, sure, and he's got a long arms, and the whole idea, another stat that comes up is perceived velocity, and the ball probably gets to batters a lot faster than it actually does, at least perceptively. So I think there's still hope for him. I mean, John Lamb, the third guy of the great Cueto trade, did not work out, and that's one down so far. But I think there's still a lot of hope for Reed and Finnegan and Stevenson. I don't think Stevenson's a lost cause. He kind of reminds me a little bit of Homer Bailey, in the sense that Homer Bailey came up here before the injuries, and he think he knew it all, and I think he got beat up a little bit and got sent back and forth to the minor leagues enough to finally say, you know what, I got to grow up and learn. And Homer, to his credit, did that. And he's a different person than he was when he first came up. And I think Stevenson will figure it out, and then we'll see what happens.
You brought up Brandon Finnegan, and Heath absolutely showed incredible signs of greatness in the 2016 season. In my opinion, I think the next, and you know, I'm definitely not a baseball, you know, scout or a coach or anything like that, but I think it would make sense, in my view, for his next level of development would be to accumulate a little more innings in his outings.
Absolutely. One thing that's kind of alarming with him was that there was a discussion, I think Zach Buchanan was the one that asked the question, but he you know, Brian pretty much had told us 5 minutes before, after one of Finnegan's starts when he went five innings, that, you know, five inning starts are not acceptable in this clubhouse. You have to be willing to pitch 7 to 8 innings per start, and that should be the minimum. Six inning quality. Brian Price hates the quality start stat. He doesn't think six innings is enough either. And Brandon Finnegan went and said, "Hey, I've gone deep into games all season. I just pitched 5 innings," and he's 23. So
coming off as a reliever.
And he's coming. Yeah, he's a reliever in the Royals, and he was a reliever a little bit here. So I think he felt, well, I got 5 innings. I qualified for a win. What's the problem? And I think, going forward, I think he's now realizing, or he will realize, that at the very minimum he should have 6, but he should always be looking for 7, 8, and 9 innings. And he's got the stuff that he can do that. I think he's definitely has multiple pitches he can work with. He's got the most important thing, probably beyond the pitches, is he's got the mentality of the competitiveness. I mean, he does not back down from anything, and he wants the ball, and he does not necessarily want to come out of a game. So I think he has the makeup to be a 200 inning starter, a 33 start a year pitcher who pitches 7 innings minimum and goes places. He has to learn to be a little bit more accountable. I think he always had a deflection for the walks, especially. He was definitely a walk prone guy, and you know, he had the term the Dookie hit, which I think didn't really sit well with other people on the team. I think he has to learn to take accountability for his shortcomings on a start, and then accept responsibility when he doesn't do well, but also, of course, be very happy with himself when he does do well.
As I'm throwing names at you, just randomly peppering you with these names, I think the babe in the system is Amir Garrett.
Yeah.
Does he have an opportunity? Will Reds fans see him in 2017?
Yeah, I think he'll be here in 2017. In what capacity remains to be seen. I could see him, if they want to go old school, I could see him starting the year in the bullpen and kind of like what Pedro Martinez did once upon a time, or Nolan Ryan, and then matriculate into the rotation. Or he could go out and win the job right away and blow everyone's doors off and send Cody Reed and Robert Stevenson and the rest back to AAA by earning the spot. I think he has a definite chance to be in the rotation to start the season. If he doesn't make the rotation, I think he's got a chance to be one of those guys. I would be surprised if they go all year with the same 5 guys. It just rarely happens. It hasn't happened here in 4 years, but I think it could happen that if somebody goes down, he's the first call, because I think he's just shown down below that he's, every time they've moved him up, he's accepted the challenge. He's grown from it. He's done what they've asked him to do, and he's produced. I mean, his numbers weren't as good in Louisville as they were in AA at Pensacola, but I think they were happy with what he did. And I think, even, you know, maybe he needs a little bit more time in AAA. It wouldn't hurt him, of course, but I think if he goes out and has a nice start, nice spring training, he has a chance.
Are we watching Anthony DeSclafani become one of baseball's best pitchers?
I don't know about baseball's best pitchers, but he's going to be that guy, though. You know it, whether it's next year or the year after. Man, he's the best pitcher no one ever talks about. That's what I think he kind of falls in, because he's again, he's not a power guy. He leans more towards the Arroyo style, where he's definitely has to use his brain a little bit more and trick guys. But he doesn't have weak stuff, though. He can throw, but he's consistent and he's steady and he gets balls in play and he does what he has to do. But he can strike a guy out when he needs to. So I could see him being an all-star for sure, and I can see him being that guy, because he's so quiet, doesn't draw a lot of attention to himself, that he will be the invisible all-star that no one talks about, that doesn't get enough recognition for Cy Young awards and things like that. I think he could be in that conversation in a few years. But he's definitely – what a great trade that turned out to be. getting him from the Marlins.
Absolutely. And we're going to wrap it up on a positive note, and I kind of purposely did this. You didn't hear us talk a lot about Joey Votto until now.
Yeah.
What I saw from him, and I'm sure you would agree with this, was one of the most amazing displays of hitting in the final since June 1. I can't remember ever seeing anything like that. And I've been with the team for a long time, been a baseball fan. I'm, 40 years old. That's not to say I've seen everybody play, but for my money and for seeing somebody day in and day out, just a truly amazing display. And I'd love to hear what your opinion is on that.
We saw a little bit of a glimpse of that in 2015, he had a very middling first half, and then he had a historical second half. But I think what he did this past year was even more impressive, just because he was hitting .213 on May 31st, and he was frustrated. He could tell he was not a happy camper. I mean, and he's a guy who makes $20 to $25 million a year. He's got this huge contract, but he does not rest on that contract. And I think because he's not as outgoing of a person, that I think people don't see that, but he is as hard of a worker, especially on the craft of hitting, as anybody. And what I saw this year was just impressive. I really never would have thought, and I should know better, especially after 2015, that he was going to come off the mat from that horrible floor he was on and do what he did. And not only just, his power came back this year. I mean, it wasn't just the hitting, and he gets criticized at times for being interested in the walks, but I don't think there was a better power hitter, in the second half than he was either. I mean, he was hitting a lot of home runs. He was driving guys in because Billy Hamilton and Peraza were getting on ahead of him. So, the idea that he couldn't drive in runs was kind of put to rest.
That's a silly argument anyway.
It is, and he's definitely shown that he is one of the best hitters in baseball, if not the best hitter. And I think if he can do slightly better than he did, even more than slightly better in the first half, and then carry that into the second half, he's the MVP. I mean,
no question. Yeah. And you mentioned the walk. He's always had that reputation as being a walk guy, and I think that's great.
Yeah.
But quietly, was that the right word? He kind of went through stretches, especially late in the season, where he didn't walk as much.
Yeah.
But he still was hitting everything.
Yeah.
And I think that was a great way to prove to his critics that, hey, look, I'm a great hitter. I don't have to rely on a walk to get on base.
Absolutely.
But that's also part of my incredible arsenal to what I bring to the plate. And I think that just seeing that, for me, like, there were stretches in which I think we were waiting. There was a milestone walk number, I forget what it was, ready to put in the game notes last year. And it felt like forever before he reached it. But at the same time, he was still hitting and getting on base at almost over 50% of the time that he came to the plate, which in my view, I think that just kind of elevated him to a different tier that only a few people are on.
Yeah, and it's just, you can't outsmart him. I mean, if we got to the point where if the Reds need a hit, Joey Votto's going to get that hit. It wasn't going to get a walk. I mean, it wasn't going to wait for the next guy to come up and do the job. And the hits were of all types. I mean, he was able to hit singles, but he definitely could drive the ball the other way and get a double, and he could certainly hit a home run. And it seemed like he was, whenever you needed a big hit, he was the guy that was hitting the big hit. I mean, Adam Duvall, for the first half, was that guy, and he kind of fell off in the second half. But Joey Votto was there day in and day out in the second half, and he had it's too bad the Reds lost 94 games, because not a lot of people saw it, and all of his basically the Reds were out of it by the time his bat came alive, so it didn't figure as much in the stretch run, and it certainly won't get him the MVP award, but it was something that everyone should take note of.
Mark Sheldon, it was a pleasure. I feel like this was the fastest hour.
Was it? Is it an hour already?
Yeah.
We didn't even talk about Different Strokes or Cats or soccer.
I know. Yeah. Maybe this will be that'll be an offline at lunch conversation, right, after I treat you to lunch.
Can't wait.
All right, Mark. Thanks for joining us. Let's do this again.
Definitely, Jimmy. Thank you.
All right, Mark. That's Mark Sheldon, ladies and gentlemen. A big thanks to Mark Sheldon. It's always nice to see what the folks who cover the Reds team on a daily basis think of the direction in which the organization is moving. It's one thing hearing it from me, someone who works for the team. It's another hearing it from someone who doesn't necessarily have those same ties. And that's what we wanted to bring you this week, an unbiased yet educated take on the Cincinnati Reds. So we thank Mark for that. He's a good dude, and as a baseball fan, it's worth your time following him on Twitter at @M_Sheldon, S-H-E-L-D-O-N. You can also read his stuff on Reds.com. Coming up this season on the BOR podcast, we'll have a litany of fantastic guests, I promise you, including Reds general manager Dick Williams. A very special thanks to my main man, Nick Prince, the best technical director in the world of podcasting. Without Nick, this BOR podcast would not exist. Don't forget to join us for the Reds Hot Stove League and Better Off Red Baseball Trivia at the Holy Grail Banks on Wednesday, November 9th and Wednesday, November 16th. That's all from BOR headquarters. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jamie Ramsey. Expect good news.